a work that we orchestrate, well-meaning, looking to God, looking to get people to come to God, but doing it with a wrong focus can end up with, among other problems, ending up to leading to merely moralism. A few weeks ago, I gave the example, as I've been trying to bring it down to earth in ways that are touchy for all of us, I said, we need to be careful as we look around and make judgments about others raising kids. You will make judgments. We're not getting rid of those judgments. But be careful. How are we doing it? Don't merely watch the behavior of parents or their children, which is what we do. That's what we could see. Say, wow, look, mom did that, dad did that, kid did that, all right? Rather, we need to focus on how they got there, how you got there. What motivates change? You're looking at training somebody. What motivates change? What drives the change in behavior? Watch out for moralism apart from change that comes from Christ. Remember what he said. That's paganism. Moralism apart from the change that comes from Christ is paganism. So in the terms of our Sunday school here, when we look at the fruits, we must look for the right roots or the source, not merely the fruits. When we look for at the fruits, we must look for the right roots or the right source, not merely the fruits. If you don't get this, and we don't get this right, then our growth is focused on ourselves. It's not from God. You'll disciple not only children, but also adults, wrongly, not only in here, but out there. We'll give the same gospel-less moralism. It's not a work of God. If we want gospel fruit in here, we must think carefully of what would show a Romans 8 life. I think we're looking at that in prayer meeting. If by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body. If you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. What would show life from the Spirit? Not moralism, arm-bending, fruit of just beating on the outside. You must have a Colossians 2, 6, and 7 course. Therefore, as you have received Christ Jesus, so walk in him, being built up in him and established in your faith, just as you were instructed, and overflowing with gratitude. Overflowing with gratitude. Think. If he is as holy as he says he is, and we talked about this, I think, on Wednesday, about the hymn, The Love of God, could we with ink the ocean fill? Could to write the love of God above would drain the ocean dry. And we said, think on that. Do you really have enough to say about the love of God, the mercy of God, the holiness, the justice of God, the truth? Think of different attributes of God. Gratitude comes from seeing that God has a way back for me, for you. Overflowing with gratitude. Well, then we seek the gospel fruit out there. The mission. So, the other example I threw across the bow was VBS, Vacation Bible School. We said it's declining because of society. You know, how do you get strangers to let their kids come in for Bible school? When I was a child, didn't matter the size of church you had, you seemed to be able to get 100 kids really easily, as people wanted their kids to have a little bit of Bible, and it was free and it was good, and so they brought them. Okay, so society's declining with that, but the decline is also rooted in church, in the Christians not doing the hard work of evangelism and discipleship in our own life. We'll just describe what that looks like. If we're not doing it in our own life, if we're not doing it inside the church, that means we need to interact with people, not just on the surface, following all of it to the soul level. That takes time. Time to build relationships where you find out what's going on at the soul level. Sometimes we're not used to being there ourselves, let alone knowing how to have that kind of relationship with somebody else. This kind of soul care inside, then we take that outside as we interact with others. That would allow a VBS to grow. See, we would have the same kind of intentional relationship with your neighbors, the coworkers, the people at work, your dentist, the banker, wherever you're going, it takes a long time, but if you're in society for a long enough time, the byproduct would be people bringing or allowing their kids to go to Vacation Bible School. The focus isn't VBS or church growth, but gospel life. Gospel life, living which would spread the glory of God. There will be gospel fruit wherever the gospel seed goes out. You see that, the parable of the soils, mustard seed. But it's a whole different view of interaction with people. It's a longer process. Don't just say Jesus when you go out to people. You say, well, I told them about Jesus. No. Who are these people? Depending on your time with them, build the world where Jesus is the answer. Build the world where Jesus is the answer. Is God a part of their world? If not, you need to start there. You don't just run in with Jesus. You say, well, no, I don't have time. I don't agree with you. If God is not in their world, you remember Mars Hill there? It says that to the unknown God, here's what I'm going to declare to you. And you go, well, he got to Jesus. Yes, I get it. But if you're not preaching in a one-time shot, you're building with people, you find where God fits into their life. If not, you need to start there. What God do they speak of if you talk to them? Tell me about your God. Is it one who goes with them? Why does this God go with them? Like a rabbit's foot used to go on a mirror in a car? Is that how God goes with them? What does God do? Why does he do it? If we don't think through these things in our own life, and if you're not looking for them with others, the words that we're saying to others, no matter whether they agree with you or not, are not according to how God defines himself, and then we're not ready for the gospel. If we don't think through these things, we're just left with hoping that people fall out of the sky for Jesus because, and we're back to VBS, they like our cookies, our personalities, and nice, cushy green chairs. Sound tough? Too much? The path is tough. You know, Jesus said, the way is narrow, it's hard. It leads to life. Few find it. It leads to life. What are the signs of success given by Phil Newton towards the end of his talk? The real sign of genuine conversion is persevering in the faith. Remember his quote, you can imitate a lot, but you can't imitate perseverance. To the extent that is true, where should we focus our spiritual energies? Let me find this here. Then we can, it's here. Okay. Oop, there it is. Ha ha, we're almost to the next one. Where should we focus our spiritual energies? On depending on the faithfulness of the Lord. He's faithful. What does this practically look like so it is not merely dependent only on our wills and our efforts? It looks like where we're focusing rather than on what we get. Where are we focusing rather than what we get, on the faithfulness of God? We're going to keep coming back to that. We could have talked more about that, but I want to move on. Before I move on, though, I wanted to show you, I don't always get to read. I tell you guys to read. I'm looking to fit it in the cracks in my life, just like I'm looking to fit it in the cracks in yours. So I'm reading two books. I was thinking about this, and this is what should be going on. You're not looking for perfect answers. You're looking to expand the world beyond where you are. That's why we interact here in a church with people that you didn't choose, that God put together. It'll bring all the flesh that's inside of you to the surface if you interact with people long enough. Okay? Well, good. Then deal with God and work through the flesh for his glory as he creates a we in here. But we also go to the universal church, past and present. And here I was reading the book on prayer. This one specifically is not individual prayer. Thankfully, the girls are reading an amazing book by D.A. Carson, Women's Fellowship. Read that one. But this one's working on corporate prayer, us praying together. So let me just read a page or a couple pages in this short book. Did I say short book? These are books you can read, and they're very quickly because they're short. Okay? Read it. Good stuff. Okay. We're talking about persevering. All right, while being interviewed about before a boxing match, Mike Tyson, all of our heroes, all right, was asked for his thoughts on his opponent's style. Tyson observed, you probably heard this, right? Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Likewise, everyone has a plan for how they'll be victorious until adversity comes. Once disorientation hits, all resolve, strength, and composure vanish like a boxer's two front teeth. Even if you, like me, haven't been in a real fight since the seventh grade, Tyson's words still ring true. My brother's passing away was the biggest surprise in my life until it was quickly eclipsed by another surprise just a few weeks later. I was surprised by how much my faith in Jesus and my resolve to stay committed to him vanished. C.S. Lewis's reflections after the death of his wife rang true for me. God has not been trying an experiment on my faith or love in order to find out their quality. He knew it already. It was I who didn't. God has not been trying an experiment on my faith or love in order to find out their quality. He knew it already. It was I who didn't. He always knew that my temple was a house of cards. His only way of making me realize the fact was to knock it down. I got punched in the face, and my resolve for the Lord disappeared. My strength dried up. I was left with nothing. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. You're not exempt. You'll get punched. Eventually, you'll realize that every single one of us has to deal with adversity. I'm not just referring to the general adversity that comes from life in a fallen world. Loved ones dying, chronic illness, death, divorce, loss of a job. I'm talking about the unique suffering that comes to Christians as a result of maintaining faithfulness to God in a fallen world. Willfully following Jesus in this world is like stepping into a boxing ring. Even if you're ultimately victorious, you're setting yourself up for punches that wouldn't have landed had you just stayed out of the ring. I'm talking about living with prolonged singleness and maybe loneliness because you resolve to allow Jesus to dictate your sexuality. I'm talking about the loss of a job because you refuse to compromise standards. I'm talking about fighting through depression and anxiety because you refuse to use illegal substances as a temporary escape. The list goes on and on. Sometimes faithfulness to God puts us in a position where we feel like obedience is a death sentence. Sometimes faithfulness to God puts us in a position where we feel like obedience is a death sentence. In those cases, how will you respond? We'd like to think our temple of faith will withstand the hurricanes, but if our history is any indicator of our present, we know that our house of cards constantly needs to be reinforced. So how will you prepare for the storm? If we wait to prepare until we're in the middle of a temptation, we're too late. We must be proactive. We need to see the storms coming from afar and reinforce our walls ahead of time. The strength we need to endure the storm ultimately comes from God, but we take hold of his strength through prayer. Prayers are our roots. The roots do the hard work of strengthening the tree, but this hard work is hidden work. The same can be said for prayer. Praying together functions as both our actual and ancestral roots. Praying together is both our strength and our heritage as those who suffer a great deal for faithfulness to God. If the previous chapters taught the standard operating procedure of prayer from the Sermon on the Mount, the whole beginning of this book goes through the Sermon on the Mount, then Christ's prayer and the Lord's prayer for the disciples, in front of the disciples. Then Christ's prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane offers the magnum opus of how it's done. He's talking about obedience puts us in a position where we feel like obedience is a death sentence. Faithfulness to God puts us where obedience seems like a death sentence. In the upper room, Jesus tells his disciples of his impending suffering, but he also tells them the truth about themselves. They'll be cowards and scatter, but Jesus promises not to return the favor. They lack the strength to stand with him, but that's the reason he's going to the cross. They will fail in the future, but those failures have no bearing on his present love and commitment to their good. What a blessing that Christ knows all about our failures, even the ones that haven't happened yet, and he remains committed to us. Then he takes his disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane, where we see more than Jesus' preaching on prayer, we see his practice of it. And then the book's going to go into how he prepared before. It talked about if we wait to prepare till we're in the middle of a temptation, we're too late. Prayer, the roots. And he goes through the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. Think about it. For time's sake, I want to combine that. Think, what are your thoughts? Here's what I'm going to ask on this. Why does that go there? Yeah. don't remember what that other one was. Let's see. What are your thoughts on that one? Any verses that come to mind? But I want to read this one now. So now I'm working with Charles and Hannah, getting ready for their wedding here in a few weeks. As we're reading Paul Tripp's What Did You Expect? Listen to this. Make the shoe fit, right? If you already got this figured out, you're married, you're not married, whatever. Make the shoe fit. All right? Planting good seeds requires help. The memories of our first garden are still alive and well in my brain. This is Paul Tripp. I was a garden novice, naive in every way. I walked out to the chosen spot, rocky, hard, and untouched soil. All I was carrying were a few hand tools and a dream of vegetables. Was I ever in for a shock? My first dig with a shovel wasn't really a dig at all. Shovel didn't even penetrate the sod, slid across the surface out of my hands. I moved a few feet and tried again, but the spot was just as hard. I went to look for a pickaxe. What was I thinking? Back at the future garden spot, I took a mighty swing with a pickaxe and made a small hole, a hole not at all commensurate with the force I had exerted. Luella, his wife, watched. I think she was trying her best not to laugh. My neighbors were probably enjoying the free entertainment while thinking, he'll learn. The next garden tool I used was a phone. I called my brother-in-law to see if I could borrow his gas-powered, earth-eating rototiller. I had been humbled by the soil's resolve, and I was ready to submit that I needed help. If you're going to pull out the deeply rooted weeds of a selfish heart and plant new seeds of self-sacrificing love into the soil of your marriage, make the shoe fit, you need help. Your instincts of self-orientation are as sturdy as the sin that still remains there. When you combine this with the fact that you won't always see yourself accurately because sin is deceitful, guess who it deceives first? You'll have no trouble identifying the weaknesses and failures of your spouse, but you won't see yours with equal clarity. All this is further complicated by artifacts of the self-righteousness that are still inside you. We all tend to be skilled self-swindlers, making ourselves feel good about what God says is not good. I know you're like me. You want to think that change needs to take place in your marriage is being inhibited by your spouse. Yet, the reality is that all of us defend what we do and say, and all of us get in the way of what God is doing. Therefore, we all need more than the hand tools of spiritual gardening. The strength and wisdom we have in our hands does not have the power to break through the hard soil of wrong patterns so that new and better seeds can be planted. I don't know if you face this fact or not, but here it is. If your marriage is ever going to be what it was designed to be, you need divine intervention. Let's consider for a moment what it looks like. You ever had a moment in your marriage when you didn't know where to turn? You know that as a couple, you're not in a good place. You know you have tried to initiate change, but it either didn't happen or didn't last. You seem to have tried everything. Nothing has worked. Well, in Galatians 5, we're told where to look. Listen to these words. So I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not gratify the desires of the sinful nature. For the sinful nature desires what is contrary to the Spirit what is contrary to the sinful nature. They're in conflict with each other. I've said this and will continue to return to it throughout this book. The big battles in marriage are not the ones you fight with your spouse. No, the big battles are the ones being fought in your heart. All of the horizontal skirmishes between a husband and wife are the result of this deeper battle. Remember, there's still sin remaining in your heart. The DNA of sin is selfishness. Since sin in its fundamental form is selfish, sin is essentially antisocial. This means that you and I must recognize there's something that still lurks inside of us that is destructive to marriage. It's important to notice that after Galatians calls us to a lifestyle of loving service, it turns to remind us of this ongoing daily moment-by-moment war. If you're ever going to have a marriage of unity, understanding, and love, you have to be willing to fight daily, but not with your spouse. You need to be committed to fighting with yourself. You need to be committed to fighting against the powerful draw of your self-focus. You need to fight the instinct to indulge those boiling emotions and powerful cravings. You need to exegete your desires, take your desires apart one at a time, corral your motives, critique your thoughts, and edit your words. There's a sentence for you. Exegete your desires, corral your motives, critique your thoughts, and edit your words. You need to battle until your litany of I wants becomes a joyful list of I would be glad to. Let me say it this way. The spiritual gardening that will make for a beautiful marriage, pulling and planting, must largely be done within your own heart. There are self-centered thoughts, attitudes, desires, motives, choices, and goals that must be uprooted from the soil of your heart, and new seeds of other focused thoughts, attitudes, desires, motives, choices, and goals must be planted in their place. And you need to remember this pulling and planting is not a one-time thing, but something that must become the lifestyle of your union. But there's something even more powerful than the words I quoted above point you to. It is hope for your marriage and mine. The words above give us more than insight into the inner dynamics of the marriage struggle. They give us the best hope ever for our marriage, no matter what condition it is presently in. In fact, I'm convinced that it points us to the only place where real hope for lasting transformation can be found. These words remind us of something that many husbands and wives are ignorant of or have forgotten along the way. Here is real hope. As you commit to the daily inner battle of pulling and planning, you are not alone. Right here, right now, we are to say to ourselves, we're not alone. God knows how big our struggle is. He knows how deep the war inside us runs. He knows how weak and blind we can all be. He knows how fickle our hearts can be. He knows how easily we lose our way. So to help our marriage, he doesn't just give us a set of principles. No, he gives us himself. If by the Spirit, what does the Spirit do? He lifts up Christ in John 16. He'll guide us into all truth. He gives us himself, Emmanuel. Emmanuel has invaded, God with us, your marriage, with an initiative of warrior grace. He is not standing outside your marriage, giving you principles to live by and judging you if you don't. No, he has literally gotten inside your heart so he can battle for you at the very place where the war for your marriage takes place, in your heart. He knows you and your spouse are not perfect. He knows sin will again and again get in the way of what a marriage can and should be. He knows that rules, principles, and perspectives are not enough. He knows that your marriage needs more than information. It needs transformation. So he's taken residence inside you. This means he battles with the dark instincts of sin that are still within you, even when you don't. If you are God's children, then your marriage isn't just a union of two. It is more accurately a union of three. Think about this. The same Spirit that now lives inside you, wife, also now lives inside your husband. His presence provides the best platform for marital unity and love you could ever wish for. He brings the wisdom and strength you need to be what you're supposed to be and do what you have been called to do in your marriage. And his sweetest gift in an agenda of grace is that he daily rescues you from you, which is just what you need but are unable to do for yourself. Hope for your marriage is not to be found in your spouse. No, it's to be found in that third invisible person who has made himself part of your union. He has come to you so that you would have everything you'll ever need to pull what needs to be pulled and to plant what needs to be planted so your marriage can be everything that God designed it to be. Yes, marriage, please look beyond that. It includes all of this. What thoughts come alongside of this? Just collect. So I didn't read that for nothing. What are you thinking? Either book, what'd you hear? What do you want to hear again? And you better find verses for it, or I will. We're not just looking for opinions or something to hang on your refrigerator. Looking for a gospel worldview. What are your thoughts? Pastor, go.
A few words left on my mind. You need to be intentional.
Mm-hmm.
You need to desire it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there. He got you started. All right. What were your intentional building for the kingdom this week? What did you do when you go, my desires aren't there? We asked. Come on. Remember way back in Future Grace? Remember we did that? Oh, you want to start again? We'll go through that book again. Remember at the end of it, we talked about getting Pastor John to like coffee before he dies? Because that's what we said. Sometimes we said that the things, if sin is I decide, then God goes, no, this is good. You're going to say, no, it's not. Well, how do you change at the desire level? And you go, well, I have no idea. Well, I don't know. He says he's attractive. I don't see him that way. you know, should you be forced to marry if you don't find somebody attractive? And you go, nope. Okay, good. Well, what happens when you see Jesus as he is, and it seems like he's calling you to a death that you don't want to die? You better learn how to face, this is what he tells me to desire, this is what I desire. That's that exegete your motive, whatever that sentence was. That was a good sentence. He's saying, walk through the metal detector of your soul. You got to go through your soul, so because it must get to the desire level. If you spend the rest of your life having to deal with the desire thing, it's worth it. The way is narrow, hard, which leads to life. And you better figure out how it is so that, because you won't be able to get there. Remember, we're coming up to Keeping Holiday again. You don't all have to read it. I've just been impacted by, you can read a million books in your life, or you can find a couple good ones and read them over and over and just think about them a little bit. All right? So in Keeping Holiday, they go for the candle maker. They can't find it, right? They lay down and sleep on the floor, right? They've finally gotten to the point where they didn't give up. They just realized, we don't know what else to do. Candle maker shows up, right? And they go, oh, there's the alley. There's your shop. We would have found it. And he looks at him with that disgusted look like, no, you wouldn't. If I didn't come, you wouldn't have found this. The founder sent me to call you, right? Desire level. And then do it. What did you do? What did you do as you analyze and went, that motive was from hell? Okay, what did you do? I hope you repented of it. And then you said, it's going to be a long road to change my motives, but here we go. And you did this one thing, right? See, George up here has practical help for me for all the things I tell him about plants and food, right? You know what his exercise routine is? Well, ask him. Some of the rest of you have better ones than me. So he comes up and asks me this morning. He goes, you did keep that food away from your desk while you study, right? Oh, okay. Well, bet I got to think about that this week, right? I think I did. But you didn't ask me if I ate my pistachios in my chair at night. You didn't, no. All right, so those are safe. Okay, yeah, you didn't know that. Okay. So do it. That's what you heard in there. What else? Oh, go, Tracy.
For me personally, what stuck out was when you were saying pulling and planting and stuff, I'm thinking, okay, weeds that are in my life that need to be pulled. I know sometimes I don't know what those weeds are.
Yes.
I mean, they're flowers.
Yes.
And
yes.
Weeds. And so it's, I got to go to my Lord and say, you know,
yes. 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 Yeah, there you go. That's Philippians 2, 12 and 13. Okay? So there's the humility of saying, show me the weeds. Remember I said that? If you think you're doing fine, I'm glad to show you somewhere you're not. When people say, who holds you accountable? As soon as I show you somewhere where you're not, you guys are watching me with a fine-tooth comb. And eventually it comes right back at me. So believe me, whether your heart is for me or not, I know I have a million places to think of that I didn't think of before I bumped into you. So all you have to do is try to help somebody to be more spiritual, and they'll tell you what's wrong in your life. Okay? But that, even that, like she's saying, is not looking high enough. We're not just looking for what everybody else can tell you. We're looking beyond. You know, what are we studying about God? You should never be able to read anything about God in Scripture without stopping to think of how he's higher than you are, worshiping, and then repenting. Repenting. Get that out of your head. Remember that it's just a beating yourself up. Yes, beat yourself up for the foolishness that you've traded something for fellowship with God. Yeah, okay, fine. Beat yourself up with that. But when you start realizing that this is the rest of your life, is to look at him, is to see yourself, is to see that he has made provision for you. First, by giving you the righteousness of Christ. We're not Catholic. You're not just having to confess everything and then try to confess all the sins you haven't caught. No, you'll never catch them all, but the humility to say, show me. Christians come to the light. This whole thing of it's none of your business, yeah, that doesn't mean you tell everybody everything, but Christians want to be seen and examined. John 3, Ephesians 5. Those that are of the truth come to the light, so their deeds may be seen as having been wrought in God. Ephesians 5, awake, sleeper, and rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. We are not of the night. We come to the light. So, okay. Show me the weeds, Lord. There's the prayer. Olga. Yeah. Yep. Yes, tangible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Prayer is not the hand tool. I think that's what you're thinking. Okay. Remember I told you the church softball game? It's church softball game because they all stand, take off their hat, and pray at the beginning. And then you act like whatever during the rest of the game, right? That prayer is just there on the side. As opposed to saying, no, I walk through this with God. I walk through this with God. Not just, hold me back. I'm going to knock him out. No, forget it. Prayer is remembering who you're talking to, what he has promised. He will bring all things to your remembrance, including looking further for justice than what you're seeing right now. They're not understanding. Remember what we just said about VBS and the rest of it? We're looking for a worldview shift, not just to get somebody to show up at church. Okay? That's why your kids, they come to church forever and then they disappear. You say, well, they got to make their own choices. Yes, but remember the marriage? That's the third party that'll pull you together. Well, that's Ephesians 4. Be diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There's one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. So the thing, look to him with that. You better figure out prayer is not just you waiting until something rumbles from heaven. Prayer is showing that everything he's given you is enough and you're going to do it with him. All right? Think Fiddler on the Roof. The daddy. He doesn't have a right view of God, and he's more whining, but he's always stopping to talk to God in the middle there. All right? You talk to God in accordance with his word, trusting that there's hope. What else? Got it, Sheldon? That's not holy. Right. Amazing how quickly we devalue fellowship. Let me reword what he's saying. Remember, 1 John 1 says, in him is no darkness at all. If we say we have fellowship with him and yet walk in the darkness. And it, again, you, see, he did a great job in there of saying what our video was saying, is it is right and wrong. I'm reading through Deuteronomy again. You love God by keeping his commandments, okay? But you've got to look beyond the principles. You're not getting your life just from principles and rules. You're getting your life from fellowship with God. And that's what he said. The third person. That's what prayer doesn't mean anything. You're against legalism, but when you're not living a life of prayer, and prayer is nothing more than, oh, I don't know, I prayed, nothing happened. I'm still mad at my wife or my husband or the church or everybody else, and I still think everybody else is a jerk. You know, what? He's like, we quickly forget. You lose the edge on holiness that, well, yeah, I'm nervous to say practicing the presence of God because I think that was Brother Lawrence and some weird mysticism and stuff in there. But I don't want him to steal that whole idea. fellowship with God is missing today. Everybody's trying to figure out what's right. What's the right view of Christianity? Go with God, a great God. Even if you're praying the wrong things, prayer is central in the solution. Even if you're misguided with how you're seeing Scripture, like Tracy said, there are weeds somewhere. Lord, show me. I think I pulled a flower, right? I do that all the time, right? But what are you going to do? You have to pull something out, and eventually you say, no, I was pulling the wrong things. And you trust the intentions of the Father. It is God who is working both to will and to work for His good pleasure. That's what He's doing. He's not going to help you grow in the wrong direction. Sandy, what are you thinking? Whatever, yeah. Right. We just follow wherever our personality is. If you're a justice person, you just, I can't figure it all out. I just want to know what's right or wrong, right? I have somebody that I know that goes, well, I'm not into evangelism. I only do discipleship, okay? I get it. Certain ones are going to be prone to different things. But the point is, when you say, I just do discipleship, how are you just doing that then? Because you cannot a disciple if you're not doing it according to the evangel, according to the gospel. The gospel is Christ in you, okay? So meaning we're going to be stronger and weaker with some things, but if you're not careful, that's why we say we don't want to do spiritual gift studies here. You go, I get it. They know how to make mashed potatoes for the Lord. You're the mashed potato maker. We don't want to do that. We want holy mashed potatoes, okay? And fill in the blank. Holy whatever, okay? So it must come from the Spirit so that we have to have His resources. You know, I was talking to another pastor, and he goes, well, I don't tell my people to read their Bible every day because that's legalism. In Acts, they didn't have copies. Everybody didn't have their own copies, so they couldn't read it. Stop it. This is the same person. If you think I'm forceful with an opinion, he's forceful, and he's so disgusted because he doesn't want everybody following him. I said, okay, well, I don't know about if you don't read it, three verses a day, the apple a day will keep the doctor away, three verses a day will keep the devil away, all right? But if we're not going to play those games, if you don't want to be the final voice in their life, they need another final voice. Where's that going to be? Then you're going to have to go to His Word. Somehow we're going to have to rethink this because all of a sudden daily devotions is somehow legalism. Maybe what we're looking for in God's Word is merit on our own, but you better get God's Word. All right? Maybe the charismatics have stolen, prayer for their own purposes and they're praying down fire and all this other stuff and they got Red Bull Jesus going on. But that doesn't mean you must commune. How about do this Garden of Gethsemane kind of prayer in there? And you start realizing that led Him through obedience to death, even death on a cross. There was prayer that was going on in there. Figure out then. We're in a consumer culture. Don't say everybody wants consumer church. You do. I do. I want a church that feels like heaven. Okay? But according to this, any two Christians marrying, let alone a Christian and a non-Christian, what did you expect, dummy? You married a sinner. There's going to be conflict. That's what he's saying. What did you expect in a church? It's easier for us to settle to the unity of each other than it is to settle to the unity of the Spirit. So sometimes we need to make conflict when there isn't. Other times, all of it is calling us to persevere. You got to have his resources, or we're going to be pulling the wrong things. Was there a last thing? Dave, go. I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming.
And the other guy gets hit hard, and he goes, I'm still conscious, so this is not over. And when it comes down to it, he tries to see like his book and he's trying to trick me that one type is like it's hit and it's over. And we want to be in the other type. I think it's hit and it's very much not over, but it's still in his place.
I'm trying to think of the reference. It's a psalm. The steps of a man, woman, steps of a man are ordered by the Lord, and this man delights in God. God delights in him. The steps of a man are ordered by the Lord, and he delights in his way. When he falls, he will not be, King James, hurled headlong. Because the Lord is the one who holds his hand. I can't remember what it is in the NAS or any of the other translations. The Lord is the one who holds his hand. That whole thing of can we're going to talk about it in the morning sermon here. After a while in Acts, you just get used to, Paul went somewhere, told the gospel, a few people believed, and a whole bunch of people yelled at him, threw something on him. Whoop, he made it out alive. He went to the next one. You know, stop. What does it look like to live this? And if you're the believers behind, what do you do? You know, he left, went to the next city because they were after his life. What did they do? The stock value of those believers goes down when there's all those riots in the city. What did they do? They look to the one who is faithful, right? And he's like, I don't know. So that Paul comes eventually and says, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. Whether we live or there's something greater than death. Okay? All right? Something greater than death. That was that quote from Wednesday night that says, if we don't settle that there's that our fears of life and death, that we're going to be hamstrung as Christians. There has to be something that goes beyond. Because otherwise, even if you aren't killed for your faith, you think, oh, this wrecked my whole life. And that's where he's saying, you know, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, he loses his soul? Something greater than death. Keep going. Keep going. All right? All right. Here, let's go to the next section. Oops, sorry. All right, go. All right, are we on? All right, we're going to go back, and now we're on.
Thank you, brother. All right, we're going to do the Tonight Show Shuffle, and Drew, come on over. Drew, who are you? Where do you serve? Tell us about yourself briefly.
Thanks. Drew Hodge. I'm a music pastor in Albuquerque, New Mexico at Desert Springs Church. Been there for 12 years, and I don't know what I'm doing up here. I wrote a letter. Okay.
That's right. Yeah. You've been in the SBC how long?
Oh, I've been around SBC churches my whole life. My dad was a Southern Baptist pastor for years. And
what state?
I grew up in Arkansas and then Florida and then to New Mexico.
Your piece is titled Worship Set, : Today's Sawdust Trail. First of all, what on earth does that mean?
Yeah, the Sawdust Trail was the name for the center aisle in the revival tents They would throw sawdust on the ground to knock down the dust from the dirt floor, from all the commotion. But the center aisle would be where people would be welcome to come forward to make a profession, make a decision.
That article is on page 104.
And the worship set is functioning in that capacity today.
I think so. I think we see particularly music as we're considering how music played a role in revivalism and still does today. I think we can see how in our churches we use music to manipulate people into feeling like they're having a moment with God and an encounter with God. And then that can feel like a worship experience. They can feel transcendent. But are they really experiencing communion with God, or are they just merely being moved by beautiful music?
Well, yeah, Drew,
who are you to judge?
Judge what?
Well, what the experience they're having. I mean, I've been in your church more than once. I know that you're a very effective, you're gifted and talented musician yourself, but you also lead the musicians that work with you well. So you're able to create
mood.
You want to say a worship experience?
Well, an atmosphere. Let me just say you're able to create an atmosphere. And
now we're using proper CCM terminology with atmosphere.
Well, I'm just wondering how you can be so confident in your dismissal of what some people express as their relationship with God. I mean, who are you to say what it is and isn't?
Oh, I wouldn't want to say that I'm absolute judge. I would say that we want to be careful in how we use the gift of music, because music by its very nature is emotional, and it is designed. God did not make a mistake in the way he made us to respond to music and art and beauty. And he did not make a mistake in commanding us to sing, to use music to shepherd our emotions and our affections for the Lord. But we just have to be careful in how we connect, and we can convolute music and emotion in a religious setting and then equate that to an experience with God.
So, well, Drew, let me answer for you by quoting you.
Oh, thank you.
You say, "I'm concerned we're using the so-called worship set to stir up tears and feelings instead of love and good works," which reminds me of a little bit of Jonathan Edwards. How do we know true revival? Right? It's not just all of these, these crazy things going on. It's that people are actually growing in holiness. And that same problem seems to be around music. Oh man, I felt so great in that moment, crying about this, but your life is unchanged through the week.
Yeah, I think about it.
So it's easier to be moved than it is to repent.
Yeah,
well
said.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, that's well said. I think about it in terms of head, heart, and hands, or thinking right leads to feeling right and then right action. So we need to be thinking about that as church leaders, as song leaders, as pastors, in how we organize our services, our liturgy, our order of service, whatever you call it in your church, about how we are to help and train our people and teach our people, even in the way we structure our services, to think rightly about God, to feel rightly about God, and then to live rightly in light of who God is and what he has done for us in Christ.
You explain four things that kind of create the problem. Number one, weak ecclesiology. Number two, emotion-driven music. Number three, overemphasis on high production. And four, a cult of personality and preference. Can you, what should we unpack? All four are interesting. Weak ecclesiology?
So I want to give credit where credit's due. I'm leaning on another article that was written by Andrew Balish. On the six marks of revivalism. And so he helpfully points out these four areas that then I just take and connect to music in the modern church and how music is used to manipulate emotions. It's used, going back to your point, Jonathan, about weak ecclesiology, if we don't believe that God has ordered worship for us, then we can
preach the Bible, sing the Bible, pray the Bible.
Yeah, then we can just do whatever we want, right? We can reinvent the worship wheel every Sunday and try to manufacture an experience that they had last week and try to one-up it every week by just coming up with the
newest
thing.
That's going to be exhausting.
Oh, it's
back
to
Phil's point.
And it's not going to work.
No, it doesn't work.
It's going to burn people out.
That's right. Yeah, we so de-emphasize the ordinary means of what Jonathan said, singing the word, praying the word, preaching the word, and then seeing the word portrayed in the ordinary.
Overemphasis on high production.
Yeah, so professionalism, a performance nature that was big in revivalism. You just needed to have the right setting. Somebody who was a dynamic speaker was powerful with powerful rhetoric. We still do that today. We can do that as speakers and teachers, but we can certainly do that as musicians and put an overemphasis on a slick professionalism. But I also say, I think in the article, if it stayed in there, that I don't think performance is the bad word that we often say. I think of it like a surgeon performing surgery. We wouldn't see that as a negative thing. He is performing an essential act that is helpful and good and right. So when we perform as preachers, teachers, or song leaders, we perform a service to serve the congregation's participation, not to turn them into an audience. So our performance will affect the way they either participate or simply consume.
Caleb, you're leaning forward in your seat.
Yeah, it's interesting from a historical perspective. Music always played a huge part in revivalism. I mean, from D.L. Moody had Ira Sankey. That was a huge part of it. Edmund Hammond, who I talked about in my second article, he had William T. Bentley. So it was always the preacher and the musician. And it's because, not to be too cynical, I mean, God designed music wonderfully, as you said, so it has its right place. But, you know, you recognize the importance of affections in true conversion, but there's a way to twist that as well and to stimulate affections that are merely human and not the genuine affections that Edwards would talk about, that change and that supernatural change where God changes our hearts and gives us a new heart. There's a way to kind of cover over that and distort that and make it seem like that's happened through music when it actually hasn't. So that'd be the danger.
And we're out of time, which means I don't think you're going to remember next week, so we'll probably have to just start without. See, to give you hope, I went through all of this here, plus reading that, and we're right here, and there's the next segment. So, and so we have two questions here. This is what you need to look on. It's on the website. Check out the website, all right? Cindy has done a lot of work on this. It's under Other Messages. Put in the password Living Faith, capital L, capital F, no space in between, Living Faith. And you can get to these. She's done a good job of putting this up. I think that even the videos are there and the PowerPoints. So, all right, here's the questions. Reading them, no time to answer. We got to quit. While we might all say we agree the focus shouldn't be on the professional or on the perfect in our music services, where do you think we practically undermine that? Now, I took notes in here. I've been encouraging, if I'm going to start again by just starting that segment, take notes if you didn't. I have some amazing statements from there. Okay, second one here, how do we protect from the danger of stimulating human affections rather than seeking the supernatural change which produce genuine affections? We have become so cynical that, one, if our emotions aren't moved in a service, it wasn't good. On the other side, if our emotions are moved in a service, it's still not good. And depending on our personality, we're on opposite sides of all of that. And emotions are supposed to be part of a relationship with God. Think about this. We're not going to solve it. Those two questions, and then we move to the next segment. Father, would you help us as we think? You know, that this went longer than I thought, maybe not longer than they thought in working through this video. But help us, Lord, to be able to do what Paul Tripp was saying there about exegeting our motives and our whatever, that would you help us, Lord, to just be willing to examine our thoughts, our assumptions, and thank you for where you have worked pieces that are part of the solution. But Father, it's going to be a battle. Would you forgive us for thinking if we just had one more or two more pieces that it would be right? Our marriage would be right, our life would be right, our job would be right, our feelings would be right. Lord, would you lift our gaze to the one who is able to keep us from falling and to present us before your throne. And it's more than enduring, Lord. You've told us that we will, if anyone cleanses himself from these things, will be a vessel of honor, sanctified, and useful to the master. Your name will be spread because of us, right where we are with our sin. And so, Father, change our hearts a little bit at a time. Help us to look to you. Help us to interact with each other on these things. We come in Jesus' name. Amen.